Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Arseblog 20 podcast series, in which we celebrate 20 years of Arseblog by talking to a guest about a calendar year of the site's existence between 2002 and 2022. This time around, we're talking 2013, and with me to do exactly that is Lewis Ambrose. Hello, Lewis.
Andrew, thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, we've got cake and party streamers and all kinds. We don't have any of that.
Arsene Wenger's having a party.
Yeah, what did he, was something bringing, who's this guy, Charlie? Not sure who he is.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know him.
Never heard of him. So 2013, it's an interesting year, I have to say. Where are we going to start?
at the beginning, I suppose. I don't know. Have you got a sort of running order in your head, or have you been doing that for these? Have you done these just sort of January to December?
Whatever way it comes out, just whatever incidents you picked, we discuss them and we go at them in whatever order you like. I mean, there is some sense to doing them vaguely chronologically, but you know.
Vaguely. What's the first thing you think of? What was the first thing you thought of when you asked me which year I'd like to do? And there were a few already taken, and then I picked this year. What's the first thing that pops into your head when you think of 2013 for Arsenal?
Mesut Ozil.
Yeah, pretty much, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Should we start there?
Why not? Let's talk about it. It was, I mean, the context, I suppose, of the signing is that Arsenal had lost their first game of the season to Aston Villa. Anthony Taylor doing Anthony Taylor things. And we lost 3-1 at home. And, well, it's fair to say people weren't best pleased.
To put it mildly. I remember that game, there were injuries for, I think, Kieran Gibbs. There was a concussion for Bakary Sagna. Then we went down to 10 men as well.
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure we ended the game with Lucas Podolski at left back and Aaron Ramsey at centre back. It was only the last like 2 minutes in injury time while we were chasing an equaliser. But if memory serves, I'm pretty confident that it was like Jenkinson, Ramsey, Mertesacker and Podolski as the back four for the closing couple of minutes of that one.
Wow.
And yeah, you can, when you hear that and then you think that we hadn't signed a striker as well or any sort of creative player either, I think you can understand the quite furious atmosphere that engulfed.
And we'd let quite a lot of, you know, top-class attacking talent go that summer because André Arshavin left, Gervinho left, Marouane Chamakh left, and, you know, of course, André Santos left. Always a threat, that guy.
Yeah, we'd ended the previous season really strongly too. We'll obviously talk about that at some point. Then I think we turned up. We scored the first goal of the Premier League season that day. Olivier Giroud scored quite early in that game against Villa. And then there was just fury after Villa came back, beat us. Anthony Taylor, as you said, had his hand involved there, a disgrace to his federation. although not yet at that point.
He was building up to it.
And then fury. We hadn't signed Gonzalo Higuain, who was booed at the Emirates Cup because we'd decided not to pay the amount of money that was wanted for him, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what happened. But it was a mad summer building up to that, wasn't it? Because the Higuain thing had been going on like all summer long. Was that also the summer of Suarez?
It was the summer of Suarez, yeah. Luis Suarez on the front page of Guardian sports section begging Liverpool to let him leave because of the £40 million plus another pound bid. That what do you remember thinking at the time? Like, did that... I couldn't get my head around at the time why that wasn't accept, like why Liverpool got away with not accepting this bid, unless obviously now I think we all know it probably just wasn't really written properly into the contract.
Yeah.
But I couldn't understand at the time how the club could just say no, and everyone sort of knew this bid existed or this clause existed for over £40 million. I obviously understand the sort of ridicule because it sounds so ridiculous, but I just didn't really get why Liverpool got away with not letting us sign him.
I don't think it was an official release clause, was it?
Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, it was just like a tacit agreement with Suarez and his agent that if you know, a bid came in over £40 million, they would talk about it or let him talk to the club in question or whatever. It wasn't a release clause as we might understand it, you know?
Yeah, which at the time we didn't know, obviously.
Yeah.
There was talk of a release clause. So, yeah, we had Luis Suarez begging to come and join Arsenal. Imagine what that could have turned out like.
Yeah.
Obviously then went into the North London Derby the day before deadline day, having not signed anybody.
Yeah, and the Higuain, he ended up going to Napoli. And, I mean, there was all sorts of stuff with Higuain and his brother or his dad or whoever was his agent.
Well,
and
it's always a brother. Why is it always a brother?
Yeah. I don't know.
Nicolas Anelka, Houssem Aouar last year. There always seems to be a meddling brother involved on the agent side of things.
Yeah.
It never seems to pan out our way when that happens either. But yeah, I think we started all right after that. We started really well after that disappointment against Aston Villa, and obviously played Spurs on, I think it was the 1st of September.
Yes.
And beat them 1-0. Remember, not just Olivier Giroud's goal, but a great save from Wojciech Szczesny. I think it was Defoe who hit a ball on the turn.
Right.
And it took a big deflection, and Szczesny, right near the end of the game, it was like 5 minutes to go or in the final 5 minutes, leapt across the goal. I actually remember being on the train on the way to this game with my brother and seeing, we'd been linked, there'd been all this talk about Real Madrid, right? And they're going to sign Bale, so they're going to have to let someone go. And it was the 1st of September, so deadline day had been like moved to the 2nd of September because of the weekend.
That's right.
And then I remember seeing the Real Madrid team and Mesut Ozil not playing on the train on the way to the ground, and Benzema was playing and Di Maria was playing. And me and my brother on the train very quickly got quite giddy about the idea that, well, if he's not playing, maybe he's the one that they could possibly sell. Obviously, not knowing anything about it, not having any idea, we'd been much more strongly linked with the other two. But they both started, which just felt a bit weird. So we were like, maybe we've got a chance to sign in Mesut Ozil. And then in the pub after the game, you start to hear about these quotes trickling through from Arsene Wenger and his little smile with Sky Sports.
That's
after,
right,
we'd won the game.
Yeah, the hint that something was coming. But the idea that he was going to come in at that point, and for the kind of fee that was being talked about, it seemed sort of fanciful. And I know it was one of those situations where a lot of pieces needed to happen. You know, there was some subterfuge as well, wasn't there? Because Daniel Levy at Tottenham was not willing to sell Gareth Bale to Real Madrid if he thought that they were going to sell us Mesut Ozil. So it was a weird thing that they were trying to keep their interest under wraps. And I don't know if it was Gazidis or Dick Law flew to Madrid, one of them anyway, and one of them flew somewhere else to make it look like they were looking at some other player. It was all a bit mad.
Yeah, crazy. And then in the end he was on international duty as well, I think, right? So we didn't even get to see him at the ground. There was no press conference or anything for sort of 10 days or so. So we signed him, but he did his medical in Germany with the national team. Arsenal obviously had a camera over there to get an interview with him that went up on the website. I seem to remember anyway, but we didn't. That was it. Then we had to wait 10 days to actually see him put on an Arsenal shirt. And it was, it was just strange. I think it was quite, as a fan, it felt quite cathartic after all these years of losing world-class players.
Yeah.
To then go out there and be able to sign one. And I mean, other than Dennis Bergkamp, probably since Dennis Bergkamp, the biggest name that Arsenal brought to Arsenal. And even Bergkamp arrived off the back of a sort of disappointing couple of years in Italy. So this felt like the first time, maybe the first time ever, Arsenal would sign like a world superstar at the very top of his game. Just having missed out on Suarez and Higuain as well, just really, really exciting.
Yeah, I'm just reading back on what I wrote at the time on Ars blog, and I said, yesterday we've pulled off one of the most incredible pieces of business in the club's history and brought one of the best players in the world to Arsenal Football Club. And I know there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then, and things didn't end well for anyone, I don't think. And we're not here to relitigate that entire situation or anything like it. But at the time, it was so, so exciting, wasn't it? That this was what we were, A, capable of doing financially, and B, what this guy was going to bring to us on the pitch, because he was only 24 when he signed. You know, he was 24 years of age, heading into the prime years. The talent was unquestionable, and we were looking at this guy as, oh well, this is like someone has pulled back the curtain on a new era for Arsenal. That's what that signing felt like. I mean, there were, you know, the Sky Sports pictures on deadline day when it was announced. You know, he's, everyone's dancing and jumping around outside the stadium, and you know, it was almost like a, almost like we'd won a cup or something.
Yeah, it was. I think you have to remember that it was 8 years since we'd won a cup, and I think that played into it, and that, you know, did that desperation for that spell without a trophy, without competing at the very top and for silverware and in finals, just waiting for that, hoping for that to end. And I really think tied up in all of that, the celebration, the joy that him signing for Arsenal brought, was this, we'd lost so many big names in the preceding years.
Yeah.
And especially the two directly preceding years in Fabregas and Van Persie, two truly world-class, superstar-level players.
Mm.
For us to be able to nonetheless draw one to us, one that, yeah, I think there wasn't much indication for most of the summer, like I say, that Real Madrid would even be willing to let him go. I mean, how times have changed a little bit recently, but for Real Madrid to not be willing to let a player go, or not be happy to let a player go, a player that dovetails so well with, at the time, Cristiano Ronaldo, a player that we'd all seen, because I think that was another part of the excitement. Sometimes you sign a player, even the big name players, and people maybe haven't seen so much of them. But Mesut Ozil had burst onto the scene during a World Cup, which means everybody had seen what he was capable of 3 years earlier. It was, yeah, it was, personally, definitely the most exciting signing Arsenal have ever made. I don't know if you feel about that. Obviously, you can remember the likes of Bergkamp signing for Arsenal better than I can, and Ian Wright, for example. I don't know where this ranks alongside those.
I think it's, you know, it's different because of the way that transfers are done now, and the way that they play out across social media and our internet and everything else. I mean, I remember being amazingly, incredibly excited that we were signing Dennis Bergkamp, but I heard about that signing when I was working in a radio station in Tipperary, and I was in the newsroom, and the person, the sports person, said, oh, Arsenal are signing Dennis Bergkamp. I mean, I had literally nobody to talk to about it. Nobody there gave a shit. No, nobody in the radio station cared one bit. And it was like an incredible signing for Arsenal to make at that time. I remember just thinking, holy shit, Dennis Bergkamp. And I think we signed David Platt that not long afterwards, or around the same time as well. You know, and it was just so different because there was no one to share it with, you know, not anyone to call up. You're just going to ring someone. Hey, we've signed Dennis Bergkamp. Well, I don't care. I don't, you know. And there weren't too many people, I'm telling you, working in Tip FM who gave a single shit about Dennis Bergkamp or Arsenal or the Premier League or the Premier.
Just the one.
Yeah, just the one. So I think you're right. In terms of overall excitement levels, I don't know that there's been anything quite like it since. I know Alexis Sanchez the following year was an exciting one too, but certainly this, particularly after the frustration, after losing players, like you said, after a long period where it felt like we couldn't compete with clubs to make the best signings, to sign the best players. Just financially, we weren't there. So it was like blowing all kinds of cobwebs away.
Yeah, and I think our only signing to date that summer, before deadline day, before that one, it was Matteo Flamini returning to the club. I think that was the only deal we'd done. Oh, Yaya Sanogo on a free transfer as well, if you want to throw that one in there. So, you know, to think we went into a summer, we'd ended 2012-13 really, really strongly. Once again, the old Arsenal thing where, and I'm sure this will feature throughout these 20 podcasts, with people saying we were just one signing away, and that really was that feeling, I think, that at the time, and probably since then, that was the last time, or a couple of years after that, that's sort of gone away since then, since the sort of mid 2010s. But there really was that feeling that we were one signing away, or two signings away, and to sign a world-class player, having only added Sanogo for free and Flamini returning to the club for free in the summer so far, was obviously just massive. And he started really, really well. I mean, I think Mesut Ozil generally his first few years at Arsenal were really good, but the first half of that first season, even then, I think he pretty much hit the ground running. He got an assist.
In his first game,
against
didn't he?
Sunderland.
Yeah. Olivier Giroud goal, I think, yeah.
Yeah, there were the early goals against Napoli and Norwich. It was sort of all what we expected, I think, when he arrived for those first, at least for that first half a season. Players sometimes take a lot longer to settle, but it didn't feel like that with him.
No, he seemed to fit in straight away. That's for sure. What else have we got from 2013?
Well, I mean, it's a little. It's not quite as happy, but...
Hey, listen, we're doing 20 years of Arsenal. So this podcast, this series of podcasts, it fluctuates between extreme happiness and complete misery. So don't worry about bringing the tone down. That's why I picked
2013. I don't think we delve into complete misery at any point in 2013, which is part of the reason that I picked it. I definitely didn't want to go into one of those years. The start of the year wasn't good. We'd lost a few Premier League games. I think we were 7 points behind Spurs in fourth. We'd sort of recovered a bit, and then we lost at White Hart Lane. I've sold this as not too happy, but now I'm just going to laugh about Tottenham. So
yep, go for it.
It's actually pretty fucking great. White Hart Lane, and we lost 2-1. Per Mertesacker scored, but we didn't ever look like getting back into the game after 2-0 down. And then Andre Villas-Boas decided to say that we were now in a negative spiral.
Yeah, the kind of negative spiral that sees you not lose a game between that defeat and the end of the season, and somehow Tottenham finish outside the top four, that kind of negative spiral?
The kind of negative spiral where you go away to Bayern Munich and win 2-0 in your next match.
And almost, you know, beat them on away goals.
Perhaps the greatest of the history, the string of glorious failures we had in the Champions League in that period. To go, obviously they ended up winning the Champions League that year and the treble. They'd been in the final the previous year as well, so I don't think there's any doubt that they were really the top team in Europe at the time. Barcelona had that crown over the previous 4 or 5 years. I think Bayern beat them 7-0, 7-1 across the two Champions League semi-final legs that season.
Wow.
To think that we got within one goal and within one more chance maybe knocking them out.
I remember that game. They were like, they literally in the last 5 minutes, they were doing the thing where they were keeping the ball in the corner flag up as far away from their own goal as possible, which is, fiercely annoying, but also, in some ways a backhanded compliment, that there was a sense that they kind of needed just to be as safe as possible.
They strolled to the Bundesliga title that year. They beat Barcelona. They scored 7 against Barcelona, definitely, across the two legs at the semi-final. I think we're the only team that even came close to scaring them. I think you're right, that last. And they, let's not kid around either, they smashed us at the Emirates. They just walked through us completely. To go to Munich and score early and then score late, I think we were probably the only team that gave them a real scare in the Champions League that season. And it was this horrible Jekyll and Hyde Arsenal, I guess, where we could turn up, and I think we'd just been knocked out of the FA Cup by Blackburn a few weeks earlier as well. But then we can go to Munich and win 2-0, which is completely ridiculous. It was also the feistiest I've ever seen Arsene Wenger in a press conference, I think.
I don't remember that.
Was this not the press conference when he was sat next to Mikel Arteta and he was, I think, maybe it was around the Blackburn, somebody had mentioned the Blackburn game. I think it's before the first leg of against Bayern. And someone mentioned the team being weak against Blackburn in the FA Cup, and he sort of said, oh, we had 9-10 internationals on the pitch. I'm sure you'll be able to find it somewhere.
Yeah.
And he really, I think he really snapped. And it was, I think this was the time then talk came out that he was going to sign a new contract. And he had a go, I think, Neil Ashton for running that story, because it was sort of suggesting that that story had come out a particular time when they knew it would be inflammatory, when we'd just been knocked out of the cup. And I think he turned around and said, oh, well, we just won't bother playing against Bayern Munich then. We're going to lose anyway, basically. Talking along those lines in his pre-match press conference. I think that was before the first leg, which obviously we did lose. But yeah, that was one of the first times in a press conference, not pitch side, that I remember him being really, really tense, and one of the first times that I genuinely thought that if things didn't improve quickly, that he'd be gone quite soon as Arsenal manager.
Right. Well, yeah, I remember that. That was the, you know, why do you look at me? And he went, the guy went, well, it's your press conference. You know.
and then he didn't know what to say, right? He was sort of like, well, fine. Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
But you're right, then we played Tottenham, we lost at Tottenham and didn't lose again for the rest of the season. And in a bizarrely steady, uneventful kind of way as well, like a lot of 1-0s. You mentioned Newcastle at the end of the season. With QPR, we went 1-0 up in the first minute and then nothing happened for the other 89 minutes.
God, yeah, I remember that.
I think there was a run. In that run, there was a game against Norwich where we'd gone 1-0 down and scored 3 goals in the last 5 minutes to win at home. It was a really weird spell where it's like Arsene had sort of just put aside the way that he usually sort of prioritised playing with these principles and trying to play entertaining football and win games with 2 or 3 or 4 goals. Suddenly results mattered more for that last couple of months of the season, and it paid off.
Yeah, that was the Tottenham defeat, if I remember, was the beginning of the end for Thomas Vermaelen. It was after
I looked this up knowing that we were going to talk about this year. Thomas Vermaelen started 24 of the first 28 games of the Premier League season, and then one of the last 10 after the Tottenham game.
Yeah, he decided then at that point that Mertesacker Koscielny was the partnership for him. In some way, like, it's not completely on Vermaelen, but the defending for like at least one of those Tottenham goals was just appalling. And I think he knew he had to do something.
Isn't it weird thinking back that Mertesacker arrived in Koscielny in 2010, Mertesacker in 2011, and now we're talking about the spring of 2013 before Mertesacker and Koscielny was just undoubtedly became the first choice centre back pairing, which feels really strange, because when they played together and especially when they started playing together then, it felt so obvious that they belonged playing together alongside each other, and we were so much better when they did.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I do wonder if Mertesacker hadn't had that big injury in his first season, whether that might have established itself a bit more quickly. But when you think about the timing of that.
Possibly just got trapped in this weird captaincy trap that we kept getting trapped in after that spell as well.
Yeah,
and Vermaelen was sort of he was the vice captain, right, when Van Persie left. So it felt like he kind of had to become the new captain. And then because of that, it felt like he just had to play every game. It would have been hard, I think. I think it's always hard to appoint a new captain and overlook the vice-captain, but it would have saved Arsene Wenger quite a few selection headaches if he'd have just gone with Arteta or Mertesacker immediately,
yeah,
rather than handing it to Vermaelen at the time just because he'd been at the club longer and because he was the vice-captain the previous season.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's a good job. Issues with the captaincy are no longer something that we have to concern ourselves with.
No, not at all. Not at all. But it was quite the turning point, that Tottenham game. And like you say, Vermaelen was out. I had a look as well at Aaron Ramsey, who wasn't really injured at all that season after he'd sort of fully recovered the previous season. But it felt like we didn't really know what to do with him or where to put him in the side. And Fabregas and Nasri had left the previous year, so it felt like he was shoehorned into a more advanced position that didn't really suit him. Like Vermaelen, or the opposite, really. He came into the team for that run. He'd started 12 of the first 29 Premier League games of the season and then started the last 9 in a row. Him and Arteta at the base of the midfield, and it wasn't the goal scoring Aaron Ramsey that we saw later. It was just a sort of
the foundations.
The hard working box to box Aaron Ramsey. You had the sort of the first choice back four had been established. Arteta was there, but it was a bit wishy washy the second half of that season, or that whole season after Alex Song had gone, who his partner was or should be. And it was just during that spell, really, that Ramsey came in. And I think the first time since his injury that we saw him again and everything that he was capable of.
Yeah, I mean, it did. I always thought that was a good partnership when it clicked, Arteta and Ramsey. You know, they had quite complementary qualities in that. Arteta was so steady at the base of the midfield and Ramsey did a lot of work in there. I think maybe when he started getting the goals in his eyes every game, he tilted a little too far towards that end of the pitch. But when they worked together, I think they worked together really, really well.
Where would you rank that in our midfield partnerships of the last, I wouldn't say 20 years because the first 10 years kind of picks itself, I guess, but since then,
since Fabregas left. I mean, the thing about Fabregas was that he never really had the proper partner, you know? That's my big regret when it comes to Cesc at Arsenal, is that he just never had the proper partner. Like, I know we tried to get Xabi Alonso, but mostly it was Diaby or it was Danielson or it was Alex Song. And with the greatest of respect to all of those guys, you know, it's always been a bit like having a Ferrari engine in a sort of Ford Cortina body, you know? That's what it felt like to me. So I'm trying to think of partnerships since then. My mind is completely blank now about the players that have been
I guess
there.
You could, Ramsey, I'd go Ramsey, Arteta, then it sort of became Cazorla and Coquelin.
Yeah. I mean, that was mostly Cazorla, I think. no, I mean, again, I do. I think Coquelin came in and played really well, but Cazorla was just such a special, gifted player that, you know, I think he carried a significant part of that burden.
And then everything else since then just involves Granit Xhaka.
The less said about that, the better. What else have we got from 2013?
What else from 2013? Well, Andrew, I have a question for you. How highly in the 20 years, the best Arsenal goal you've ever seen, how high is Jack Wilshere's goal against Norwich?
Pretty high. Pretty high. Like top 10% for sure. For sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm replaying it in my head here. It is just
top 10% doesn't sound that high.
Okay, top 5% then, for sure. No, maybe it's in the top 5. Who knows?
I'd have to think about it. Top 5 goals.
Top 5
goals.
Yeah,
that's what I'm just... top 5% or goals. There's top 10% is like...
Yeah, that's a lot of goals, I realise.
Like 10 goals, or 100 goals a season? So you're talking like 200 goals?
Okay, look, listen here, Mr. Mathematician. I was just trying to say that it's very high up there. It is. in my top five. I'd have to read a list of every single Arsenal goal to go over them. But as one of those that sticks in your memory as something that you haven't really seen before. Like, we've all seen good team goals. We've seen the thumping headers. We've seen the incredible, long rangers, all of those kinds of things. But as a goal that sticks in your memory because of how rare it was and how just precise everything needed to be for it to happen, it's right up there for sure.
The next thing I wanted to ask you about or bring up is a bit of a controversial opinion, I think.
Okay.
I think 2013 is the best evidence that Santi Cazorla played his best football for Arsenal out wide.
I don't know that that's controversial, per se.
I think if I tweeted this, people wouldn't be very happy about me saying it.
I think what would happen is people would think that you're downplaying what he did when he moved centrally at a point where we didn't really have a great deal else. And he was just so good he could do it, but I don't think it was ideal or, to my mind, the best use of Santi Cazorla. So I would agree with you in that one. I don't think, for me, that's not controversial.
See, I thought we might have an argument about that.
No.
So he moved into the, he moved out wide. I remember Thomas Rosicki had injury after injury, obviously. I think this was the last season that we ever really saw him, and it was only for the last couple of months of the season. And I personally, it was Cazorla's first season at the club, and I personally thought he, not that he was poor before, but came to life when Rosicki was in the team. I don't know if it was playing wide or if it was having another person on his wavelength to play with, in that attacking midfield position, someone to link with and someone on that same wavelength. And then obviously he played wide as well the start of the next season because we'd signed Mesut Ozil. But I often thought that Cazorla, that was the best that we saw from him. And yeah, I feel that a lot of people would disagree with that.
They might do, because I think it's those performances when he was in the centre of midfield, that Man City game, for example, where he was just so outstanding, and we had such an, like, here's the reality of the situation that we were in. We had so little to choose from in central midfield that we brought back Francis Coquelin from Charlton, where he was on loan and was expected to stay after he'd been on loan with Lorient and Freiburg, and his Arsenal career really wasn't going anywhere. And to be fair to him, he came back in and did, I think he did well. Like, I don't think he was ever the best player by any means, but he brought something to that midfield because he saw it as a chance and an opportunity. And I think the pairing with Cazorla worked really well. But I think you get more out of Santi when you play him higher up the pitch.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to bring on to Thomas Rosicki, because it was the last, I think it was the last time we ever saw like a real run of games from him for Arsenal. And I just wanted to ask, I know that you're a big fan of his, or I think you're a big fan of his, and wanted to ask what you think of Thomas Rosicki, basically.
I really liked him. I think his career was so affected by injury. I mean, he did stay at the club until 2016. So, there was a contribution that he was able to make. I remember when we sold Robert Pires left, and then was announced we were going to bring in Thomas Rosicki, and the first thing that he did was smash in a goal against the US at the World Cup in 2006. And I was thinking, yes. And then he scored his first goal for Arsenal. Was it against Dortmund? It was in the Champions League anyway.
Hamburg. That's where, right, we had Dubai on the front of our shirts.
That's right.
Because they were sponsored by Fly Emirates.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I really liked him. I just think it's a shame that the injuries took their toll the way they did, because his technical quality was outstanding. And he was one of those players who could give you just that burst of 5-10 yards through the lines in tight games that made a difference. So, yeah, I was a fan.
Yeah, I think people now have seen quite a few people compare or say that Smith Rowe reminds him of Rosicky, and I think that is true in the best way possible, in that yeah. Rosicky sped everything up when we played. I think Smith Rowe does a similar thing for the team now. We were a team back then that, you know, that whole walk the ball into the goal kind of thing that people like to say about us. And he just injected something into the game. And I think it was 2013 was the second year in a row, basically, that he came into the team for me and got us into the Champions League.
Mm. Should we just very finally talk about the, you know, the start to that season? We already talked about Mesut Ozil when he came in, but at one point, I think we were in November or December, something like 5 points clear at the top of the table after a run of wins in the, did we win like something like 7-8 in a row, or we went unbeaten for 8, and then we, you know, we got to December and it was going well, and then there was that Man City game where Mesut Ozil didn't say thank you to the fans, and Per Mertesacker scolded him very publicly about it. But you know, when it comes to the Premier League, we weren't too far away until, you know, towards the end of that season, things started to go really wrong. But, you know, it was a very, very strong start to the season after, you know, that Aston Villa game had everybody in high dudgeon.
Yeah, I think we were like properly in a title race this year. We fell off early in that title race, and that's obviously, you know, something for 2014. But 2013, I don't know if we ended the year, but I think we ended the year top of the table. We were really good. The Villa game was obviously poor. We lost again at Old Trafford because that's what happened back then. And we did lose the game at City. I mean, Everton and Chelsea at home as well, two draws, and Olivier Giroud had chances to win both, frustratingly. But otherwise, we were really good. We were defensively solid. That same base that you mentioned, or that we talked about, that had ended 2013 was still the base of the team, the midfield, the same back four, Kieran Gibbs, that centre-back partnership, Bakary Sagna, and then Ramsey and Arteta ahead of them. But we'd added Mesut Ozil, and Aaron Ramsey had added a goal every two games, pretty much. So we looked like a proper team. I think for the first time for a few years, we looked like a team. You know, the previous seasons had all been about recovering in the second half of the season. Mm. Like the last two seasons, at least, had been about recovering and scraping fourth on the final day, that sort of thing. This did fall off, obviously, and there was a brief time when it looked like Everton might pip us to fourth when we'd gone on a really bad run. But 2013, I think we were the best team, or the team that picked up the most points in England. So, yeah, it's looking back, that's one of the seasons in the years since we haven't won a league title where I look back and think we definitely could have actually won the league that year.
Yeah, we should have been contenders. We could have been contenders, as they say. But
it does help when one of your midfielders starts scoring a goal every other game.
It certainly does.
Everything just sort of clicked with that side. I thought it was a really likeable Arsenal team, for maybe want of a better word.
Yeah.
You know, with Arteta and Ramsey, with Mesut Ozil coming in, Cazorla, Walcott, Giroud. It was maybe the last time, or one of the last times, that Jack Wilshere was really fit, really fit for half a season, and could plug into those sort of attacking midfield positions, and got taken out of the centre of the pitch where he was getting kicked so much. It was a really good Arsenal team, and not just in the league, but we won in Dortmund in the Champions League. I think we topped the group with the group that had them and Napoli in it as well. So yeah, a really tough Champions League group. We ripped Napoli apart at the Emirates and won in Dortmund. It was a really good side, and you know, some really good performances. Aaron Ramsey's goal-scoring run obviously sticks out in that whole period as the thing that propelled us, but it was by no means him and him alone.
No, it wasn't. And like you say, it was a good team that played good football and probably should have done more. But 2014 is to come in another episode. Some ups and downs in that one. But for now, we'll leave it there. Lewis, thank you for reliving 2013 and some of the moments with us. Much appreciated.
My pleasure, Andrew. I just hope the podcast doesn't go on a negative spiral from here until 2021.
Let's hope not.
There you go. I've set you up for a winner.
So. Thank you.
Hey, Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Lewis is on Twitter at LG Ambrose, at LG Ambrose. And of course, you can hear Lewis before every Premier League game. We do a preview podcast over on Patreon. If you want to sign up for that, you can do it at patreon.com/arseblog. Just one of the extra things you get if you become an arseblog member on Patreon. patreon.com/arseblog. Right, let's leave 2013 behind, because there is an auspicious year coming up in which we see the end of the trophy drought and much more besides. Thanks for listening to this one, and we will, of course, as we always do, catch you on the next one. Until then, etc. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.